Well, I want to say Shabbat Shalom to everybody. Hope you're having a great day. Hope you're all looking forward to the ice cream tonight. We've got a lot of ice cream yet to eat. This is your mitzvah for the festival to finish up the ice cream, because otherwise Mark's going to have to take it all home. All right. For those of you who know me and know me for a long time, you could you know that I'm somewhat cynical. And just 12 months ago, if I had told you the story that I'm getting ready to tell you now, you would probably not believe it, because I wouldn't believe it either. But people change, and I think that the events that happened to me have caused me to change. You know, the Hebrew Roots Walk didn't start 15 years ago, and it didn't start 80 years ago. Nor did it start, but it did start 3,500 years ago with a man named Abraham. And when Abraham came out of Ur of the Chaldees and he headed to the promised land, he had a lot of changes to make because, you know, Abraham wasn't perfect from the get-go. He had a lot of things he had to change. And so events in your life happen that cause you to realize that you've been doing things wrong in the past and you need to make them change. Or make some changes. And so this story that I'm going to tell you is one of the events that probably caused me to want to make the most changes in my life at any one time. And as we go through the story, you'll see why. Now, I'm going to tell you this story for a number of reasons. The second reason is because God tells us to praise His name and declare His great works. And we see that in a number of passages. Is that on? You got the slide thing over there? There you go. Declare His glory among the nations, His wonders among the peoples. This is one of the many admonitions we have to tell our friends and our family and our brothers and our sisters about the great things that happened to us, things that we would call miracles, things that we, at times past, would probably have shunned, or we would have looked at someone and say, ah, come on, is that really true? Well, you know, as I said, experiences happen that cause us to help us to realize that some of these stories of miraculous healings and miraculous events that happen in your life are really true. They really do happen. And again, this is going to help us to see this. So with this in mind, I'm going to share with you an event that happened this past year in which Angie and I were blessed to be a part of, and it has to do with my younger brother, Keith. My brother, Keith, are we hot there? Am I changing? Bring me the other clicker, will you? Okay, my brother Keith was quite a loner. He was a very principled loner, though, right up until the time that he pulled a gun upon himself. At age 17, he left home and headed for Colorado, hiking most of the Colorado portion of the Continental Divide all by himself. And later, he took jobs building housing for those who worked on the Alaska pipeline many years ago. And then when that was through, he went down to the Gulf Coast and worked as a roughneck, working on the offshore oil rigs. All the time, though, he was pretty much alone, but he was pretty adventurous. He really liked doing a number of things. He liked the challenge of getting out and doing something else. Later in his life, he bought a 40-foot trimaran, a big sailboat, that he single-handedly sailed from Seattle, Washington, down to Costa Rica and back. He had a friend down there he wanted to visit, and so he just jumped in the boat and went. After selling the boat, he traveled to Europe again, all by himself, spent months in Europe just traveling by himself. Keith was a carpenter by trade, and he built a number of houses, mostly in the Northwest, Seattle, and then in the western part of Colorado, where he really loved. And he was a perfectionist in that regard. And because he liked to build his houses that were just right, and because he wanted to put into his houses the things that he had learned while traveling overseas, he did most of the trim work himself. He just really never trusted the trim work to anybody else. So he did it all by himself in practically all of these houses. But then about 7 or 8 years ago, my brother started going blind. And, you know, it was real slow, but he knew it was happening. And he knew that it was going to cause some problems with him later on in age as far as being able to make an income or have an income, since he was a carpenter and a trim carpenter at that. So he decided he'd just get into the rental housing market. And so he built a number of rental houses down in the Grand Junction area of Colorado. Then he bought a number of houses down through there. And this was, again, was about 7 or 8 years ago. And then the housing market crashed. And before long, he knew he was upside down on all of his houses, owing more money than the houses were worth. And also, because a number of houses were coming on the market, he found himself having to lower his rents, to where eventually he was subsidizing his houses to the tune of $1,500 to $2,000 a month. And then Keith had other problems. He had depression. He had it pretty bad, in fact. He had it to the point that he could not maintain a relationship. My brother Keith got married in early 2002, I think it was. But within about 4 or 5 years, he had sent his wife back to England, where he had met her, because he could not maintain a relationship because of his depression. He would get into these bouts of depression, and then he would go up into the mountains and camp for a couple of weeks until it was over with. And oftentimes, he would leave in the middle of the day, and she didn't know where he was at. And, of course, this caused problems in their marriage. And eventually, he sent her home. She didn't want to leave, but he sent her home, and she went back. And then in 2009, my father died. He got sick at the feast, and my son Jason raced home and took my dad to the hospital. And Angie and I came in later and nursed my dad, until he died 6 months later. And then early last year, I guess you might say the straw that broke the camel's back, my brother Keith's wife, who was living in England, filed for divorce. And so that really hit him hard. He tried to take and build relationships with another woman, and that didn't work out. And so with his world crumbling all around him, and despite the offers of help and encouragement from the rest of the family, in late June or July of last year, Keith bought a gun, told my oldest brother Mike what he intended to do, and then went out into the Colorado desert and ended his life. Not wanting to be a burden on anyone, he told Mike he was going to do it in a place where no one would ever be able to find him. And he said, "So don't try." He thought that that would be the easiest way for the family to get over him if he just sort of vanished. Since Keith knew that part of Colorado where he was going to, like the back of his hand, my brother and my mom and the rest of my family said, "Well, he's somewhere where he's not going to be found, so we're not going to go look for him." They took him at his word, and he was gone. But then later in the year, around November, the San Miguel County Sheriff's Department noticed a truck that had been sitting out in the desert for a number of days. And so they went out and checked it out and came to find out it was my brother's truck. It was about 100 miles from his home, so this was the only clue of which direction my brother had gone. And because the keys were left in the truck and all of that, my brothers and sisters said, you know, he's for sure dead. For a little while, we were holding out hope that maybe he had just vanished, just gone maybe to Canada or something to escape all of his bills. But he was too principled for that. He was always concerned about making sure his bills got paid. But nevertheless, when we found the truck, we decided we'd go ahead and have a memorial service for Keith. And so when we had the memorial service in late December of last year, we all went through and watched a movie that my sister had made and all that stuff. And it was really nice, done up really well. But in the entire thing, I to myself, I kept saying, you know, I don't know if he's dead. I don't think he's dead. I mean, he's talked about killing himself a number of times when he gets into bouts of depression, but everything always seemed to work out, and he always turned around, and he always came back, and he always did well, and things just went on. So I really wasn't convinced that he was dead, but nevertheless, I went along with the memorial service thing. But just before I left memorial service, I overheard my sister say that this relationship that he had been building with this other girl didn't work out, and she ended up deciding to marry somebody else. And so, knowing how it is, many of us men have had relationships go bad, and it hurts real bad, and so you build that on top of all the other problems. And I said, I bet he did. I bet he killed himself. So on the way home from that trip in Kansas City, I just kept mulling over, man, if my brother's dead, can't just leave him out there. If he's out in the desert, just can't leave him out in the desert. So I got home, and on Monday morning, I thought about this really hard, and I said, I'm going to find Keith. Now, I talked to my brothers over the period of time that they had, you know, thought he was dead, and I said, well, y'all want to go search for him? They all said, well, yeah, let's search for him. So I said, all right, so let's go search for him. So what I did was I called I got in Google, the international phone book, and started looking up trackers, people who could track someone down, scouts, trying to find somebody that could look for somebody out in the desert. I mean, after all, they found the truck in November, so this was January, so it's only a month and a half, 2 months. You know, surely there's remains there that could be found. And so I found a phone number there for a search and rescue person. And then when I called the number, but lo and behold, it was the San Miguel County Sheriff's Department that answered the call. And I told the lady at the Sheriff's Department, I said, oh, I must have got this number by accident. I was trying to call a tracker. And she said, well, we're the only trackers in the area. And she said, what can I help you with? And I said, well, I believe my brother killed himself out in the middle of the desert out there. And she said, oh, you're not talking about Keith Kelly, are you? And I said, yeah. She says, well, I know all about that. And she said, but I'm not the person you need to talk to. You need to talk to this guy named Chris White. And so so we called Chris White. So I called Chris White, and I told him who I was, and he says, oh, yeah, I know the story. I know the story all about of your brother, and maybe we can help him. Maybe we can help you. Okay, so I took and I'm trying to figure out how to fit this in because I jumped a little bit ahead of my story here. Let me back up here for a second. You know, when people die, and I guess this sort of frustrated me for a little while, that my family said they wanted to go search for him, but yet they were really willing to just say he's dead and let's forget about it. But I knew there was something wrong with that picture. I just knew it. And the reason I knew it was wrong is because our Sabbath fellowship down in Gladewater, Texas, we do the weekly Torah readings. And when we read through those passages in the Torah, we read about how important human life is and how God looks down upon people he really thinks a lot of humans, to the point that he makes rules regarding the how they can be treated and the dignity that they're to be extended even in death. You know, human beings are not like possums, skunks, and lizards. Human beings are not supposed to become part of the food chain. And so God expects us to go out and take care of our dead. You know, Abraham sought a place to bury Sarah. It was really important that he find a place, just the right proper place to bury her. And so he went out and he bought a cave specifically for the purpose of burying his wife. And in the scripture we read where it says that criminals cannot be left overnight, it says in Deuteronomy 21, verse 22, it says, if a man has committed a crime punishable by death and he is put to death, you hang him on a tree. His body should not remain all night on the tree, but you shall bury him on the same day. This is what is expected to be done for criminals, and my brother was not a criminal. He walked the Torah walk when he was young because that's the way my parents raised us. But he did leave the walk when he turned 17 or 18. But nevertheless, he was not a criminal. And since he wasn't a criminal, I believe that God would expect someone to treat him even with more regard than you would a criminal. And criminals at least got a proper burial. In our fellowship, we had also learned that we are to be our brother's keeper. And I had taught a lot about that in the past, what it means to be a neighbor to one another, what it means to be a brother, and how important it was that the firstborn of the family take responsibility for the rest of the family. And so I knew that one of us in our family needed to go find my brother and bury him. But since my older brothers and my younger sister weren't real gung-ho about this, I knew that I needed to do that. And so I began the search to look for my brother. And like I said earlier, in early January, I found a phone number that led to the San Miguel County Sheriff's Department, and I made contact with the search and rescue unit, a person there named Chris White. And Chris White told me that, yes, I was a part of the search and rescue team that went out and looked for your brother. But Chris said, I'm not the person you need to talk to. I guess they wanted to pass me on down to everybody. They said, you need to talk to a guy named Eric Berg. Okay, Eric Berg just happened to be the head of the San Miguel County Sheriff's Department. I never met Eric. I had been doing this process of searching for my brother for about 20 minutes by then. But within about 5 minutes, I get this call from Eric. And he had been driving down the road, and they called him, and they told him that this guy named Tim Kelly was looking for this guy that was found missing, that was reported missing a while back, that we found his truck. And Eric Berg pulled off on the side of the road and talked to me for about an hour and a half about what had happened. He told me all the details of what they had done to search for him. They told me all the details of the truck. I mean, it's almost like they told me if the white walls were clean or not. I mean, he got down to the tiniest details to tell me about what all had happened. And because he did, I really felt that Eric was really interested in me finding my brother. But after that long conversation, Eric said, but the chances of finding your brother out there are none. He said, there's 100 square miles he could have covered. He went out there, reportedly by what my oldest brother said, he went out there with two gallons of water and some food. He said he could have traveled 100, he could have traveled 50 miles in any one direction. And we just don't know which direction he went. And he said, we were out there with dogs, cadaver dogs, dogs that search for missing people. They had the Bureau of Land Management out there. They had about 8 people from their sheriff's department out there. They had all kinds of people out there searching for a long time trying to find him. And they found nothing other than what they found right around his truck, which was a broken computer, a broken cell phone, and a six-pack of beer, an empty six-pack of beer. So Eric didn't give me much help. But he said, but I told him, I said, Eric, I still want to come up there because I think there is someone who knows where he's at. And I said, I believe that I can find him. And so Eric said, well, you know, if you want to come up, I'll get a sheriff's team to go out with you and help you search or whatever. He says, you just tell me what you need. But he said, don't come up till May because it's just a mess of mud up here. And the truck was found 17 miles off the nearest paved road. And he said, it's just nothing but mud up here at this time of year. So he said, wait until May before you come up. And then my thought was, after I get off the phone to him, was, what can I do till May? Well, I'm going to tell you a little bit about my prayer life. My prayer life for 50, how old am I? 57. For about 55 years was next to none. I mean, we did do our daily prayers and stuff like that, but really not any intense prayer. But a couple of years ago, I started doing some teaching on prayer from a Jewish perspective, and I did a teaching in the fall of 2009 at our fellowship about the Amidah. And in fact, we printed up some cute, nice little Amidah sheets for those who wanted to use those. And my wife started praying the Amidah prayer on a daily basis. And then about 2 months later, I decided to do the same thing. And I found it was very beneficial, very beneficial. And for those of you who do pray the Amidah prayer, you probably have found that also. So in January, I began praying very diligently the Amidah prayer and then following that with my petitions, my own personal petitions to Yahweh. And part of those petitions was that Yahweh help me find my brother. And it wasn't just simply a questioning, saying, God, please help me. It was a, God, you've got to. Your Torah has indicated that I'm my brother's keeper and that I should bury my brother, so you've got to help me. And I would pull these scriptures out, and I would show God, and I'd read them to him, and I'd say, God, this is what you said, so you've got to follow through. You've got to help me do this. My prayers included three different things. Number one was that God would help me find my brother's body. The next was that God would help me get my brother buried, which came in very handy later on. And the third, I'll talk about a little bit later. But I knew that God wanted me to bury my brother, and I knew that if it was going to take place, he was going to have to take a part in it. Another thing happened early this year, and that is, in our group, we do some liturgy, and part of the liturgy is Hodu Lo Adonai. And I'd say if our group wanted to stand up and sing it, you guys want to? Hodu Lo Adonai Ki Tov. We sang that song, but someone asked me, said, what does Hodu mean? And so I did a study on the word Hodu. And I found out that the word Hodu comes from the word Yada, Yada, which means to give thanks. And the word Yada in its etymological, is that the correct way to say that? Meaning means to raise your hands. And I didn't know that. I wasn't looking for this when I did this study. But it just so happened that while I was doing the study and preparing for this study, we had our little granddaughter over, not Jason's kids, my other son's kids. I had both of my granddaughters over there and at over the house, and they were sitting down to eat, and my youngest granddaughter, who's 2 years old at the time, didn't want to eat her food, and I said, well, you've got to, which was a big mistake on my part. And so the battle began, and so I sat there, and she threw a little fit, and she didn't want to eat her food, and I kept saying, Courtney, I'm not going to leave, and you're not going to get up, sweetheart, until you eat your food. And she just hated me and all this. She didn't hate me. But, you know, she just made all these faces and threw this fit, and you've all seen that, right? Okay. So we sat there, and I would just sat there, sort of whistled along and stuff like that. And before long, I saw her sort of pick something off her plate. She didn't want me to see it, and she put it in her mouth. And then she went over and grabbed her plate that she had pulled away, or she had pushed away, and sort of pulled it toward her. And before long, she had eaten everything on her plate. And I said, Courtney, you're such a good girl. You can get up now. And so she got up from the table, got on the floor, and raised her hands for me to pick her up. And I learned a little bit about raising hands right then, because God tells us we're to be like little children. And that God wants to pick us up if we'll just raise our hands and say, pick me up. So this was enlightening to me, and I remember this, and slowly but surely, in fact, I don't even know if I ever raised hands in worship in our group after that until this event happened. But I knew it, and I remembered it. So May eventually came, and I called Eric Berg on May 1st, which was a Tuesday morning, and on Wednesday morning, I was on an airplane to Denver. I told Eric, I said, hey, I'm coming up, and he says, come on up, I'll try to help you out, but he says, you're not going to find him out there, it's too big of an area. But I told him I was going to come up anyway. I told him that I believed that there was someone who did know where he was, and that I would be able to find him. I got into Denver that Wednesday morning, and I took the six-hour drive from Denver to Montrose, Colorado, where I planned to spend the night. And I called Eric on the way, and I told him that my intentions were simply to come up and scope out the area. It wasn't to search him out, just to scope it out. Determine if we could camp near where the truck was found, and determine if we needed four-wheelers or anything like that to get around. But again, it was not my intent to search on this trip. It was simply a fact-finding trip to find out what I would need to do, because I was hoping that my family would come with me and help me to find my brother. And Eric said he'd meet me in Norwood, Colorado, which was south of Montrose, the next morning at 9 o'clock. So I checked in the motel that night to get a good night's sleep. And I'm going to digress right here for a moment. I'd been raised to be suspect of anybody who claimed to have seen a sign from God. I was taught that signs were taboo, that we're to walk by faith, and that only the Jews need signs. In fact, this passage right here was read to me a number of times. For the Jews require a sign, and the Greeks seek after wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified, unto the Jews a stumbling block, and unto the Greeks foolishness. Now, not everybody was taught that, okay? There is no, what's the term, monolithic Church of God. It was just probably the ones that had taught me. But nevertheless, signs were something you didn't do. And signs were certainly not something you asked for. Only unbelievers need signs, but we are to walk in faith. But I started thinking a while before that God gives us signs. He gives us the circumcision. He gives us the Sabbath. He told us the story of Gideon, who specifically asked for a sign. And he even gave us the rainbow, which is a sign for him. Because he says that when he thinks he wants to destroy us, which I bet he does a lot, and it's probably why we're getting a lot of rain nowadays, he goes out and if he sees that rainbow, he says, now I know I made a covenant with these people, I can't destroy them. That sign was for him. And if God used signs, then how could it be wrong? And I thought about this that night while I was in that motel by myself, trying to figure out what in the world am I doing over here in Colorado when I've been told there's no hope. And I sat down and I got down in that motel and I got on my knees that night with outstretched arms, and I pleaded with God to show me the location of my brother's body. I told God that the sheriff was offering me no hope. He was offering me help, but he was not offering me any hope. And if I were going to find my brother, I need a visible sign, God. I need a visible sign. And so I thought, what could lead me if I were out in the desert that would be familiar to me? And I'm an airplane pilot, and so I said, fly me an airplane right over when I'm out there if I begin to search. Didn't really care what kind of airplane, just fly me an airplane over and I'll go. I mean, airplanes aren't all that common, you know. And so the next morning I got up and drove the hour and a half down to Norwood, and I met with Eric, and Eric and a couple of his deputies went and told me all of the things again that they had done and showed me all the things. And he told me about the area out there, and he said, okay, you need to get out there. We need to have some rations in case you get lost out there. And he says, make sure you've got a good cell phone and all this type of stuff. And I didn't bring rations or any of that stuff. And so they went and got the rations, and they came, and we went out there. And it took us 45 minutes to get down to where the dirt road started. And like he said, the roads were rutted. And it took 45 minutes to drive that 17 miles on that dirt road. The ruts were so deep. And he had warned me to get a four-wheel drive car. So I rented a four-wheel drive car out of Denver, a vehicle. I got a Jeep. And so I'm glad I did, because I'm sure I would have gone, I'd have drugged something if I had not done so. And so we headed to the place where Keith's truck was found, and an hour and a half later, we arrived there. And this is the area, this picture here is of the area, or roughly the area where the truck was found. It had sagebrush to the north, deep canyons to the west, and mesas to the east and to the south, surrounded by large boulders. And when we got there, Eric showed me the still visible tire tracks of where my brother's truck was. It was sort of in a sheltered area under some trees. He showed me the beer bottles that had been spread out. Unfortunately, they were spread out all over the place, so we had no idea which way he had taken off. We saw the broken computer and all of that. And Eric said, I got about 45 minutes. I'll help you search for a while. So we started looking. We looked under trees. We looked under rocks. And we traveled around. And we walked. And we walked maybe a quarter mile radius of where the truck had been found. And we're looking along there. And then Eric says, look at that. I said, what? He says, that's either a large mountain lion or a small bear. And, of course, it was the tracks that he had seen, and they were fresh tracks. And Eric said, this is not the good season to be out here. And he said, so we probably need to get back to our vehicles, since neither of us have a gun. And so we did. And so when Eric, we got back to vehicles, and he filled me in on some things, and he says, if you go off in this direction, it drops off real fast. And he says, if you go up there, there's some big, large boulders. He says, don't get on the boulders. Because if you get on the boulders and you fall, then there's going to be two missing people out here. So stay off the boulders. He said, also, don't rely on your cell phone, because the cell phone reception out here is not really good. It's hit and miss. And so I listened to everything he said, and then Eric drove off. He had to get back to town. He had other things to do. So I was there by myself, and I looked around for some more things. There were some papers that were thrown around, and my brother had some business cards that he had burned up in a fire. He also tried to burn his computer up and his hard drive and all that stuff. And so I picked up some of the things I saw there, and I put them in a bag, and I was going to take those back home with me. And after about 30, 45 minutes, I said, well, I probably ought to go. I need to get back, try to find a four-wheelers and stuff like that so that we can come back up here. But just before I did, I just said, you know, I'm just going to pray about this one more time. So I got on my knees and I prayed. And I said, God, you know, thanks for getting me to this point. And it truly is like Eric has said. It looks like it's hopeless to find him. And so I prayed, but I said, God, you know, I want to find him. Please help me find him. And so I closed my prayer, and I got up, and as I got up, I looked up, and there's an airplane flying right overhead. And I'd forgotten about the sign thing when I prayed. I didn't pray for another sign. But that airplane just shot overhead, and it had a big contrail. Does everybody know what a contrail is? Okay. It's ice crystals that are formed by the exhaust of a jet engine. It wasn't a small airplane. It was a big airplane. And I looked up there, and I said, wow, man, what am I going to do? Because I wasn't really into signs. I'd prayed for a sign, but I really wasn't into signs. And so what am I going to do? And I said, Eric had just said, bears and lions. Bears and lions? Is that what I said? Bears and mountain lions. So I got my cell phone out, had a nice little compass on it, and I pulled it out there, and I said, okay, the compass is, you know, I got the compass, and I got the heading written down that it was going, and I said, what do I do? So I called home, I called Angie, and I said, actually, I think I talked to Jason. I think Angie's out in the garden. And I said, I might know where Keith is. I said, if I don't call you back in 1 hour, then you call the sheriff's department and have them come looking for me. And I told him how to get hold of the sheriff's department. So I decided I was going to chase after this sign that I really didn't know for sure was a sign or not. And I headed off. Now, right where I was standing was right next to a pipeline cut. And this is the pipeline cut. And you can see over on the right side of this, my mirror of my truck, or my little Jeep Laredo, whatever that thing was. And I was on that right side of that pipeline cut when I saw that airplane go over. And I said, well, shoot, I'll just get into this pipeline cut. It looks like it'd be easier. And so I got in that pipeline cut, and I sort of walked and ran. And I ran trying to follow that heading, which this pipeline cut followed pretty well. And I'll show you an illustration here in a second. And I followed that for about 3/4 mile. And along the way, I would look at the cliffs. There was a lot of rock outcroppings, and I would look under those things. And then I would go to the other side, and I'd look under some over there. And I'd jump up on these rocks a little bit, and I would see some more caves. And I did this back and forth for about 45 minutes. And you know, I covered about 3/4 mile, but I sort of crossed a little ridge there, and lo and behold, the trail went off to the east. And my heading was 240 degrees, which is southwest. And I said, what do I do now? This is a Google Earth. This is a Google Earth illustration of what happened. If you see the little green arrow down here, that's where I originally started from, where my brother's truck was found. And you can see the pipeline cut right through here. And this is where I followed it. And right there is where I saw the road turn off to the left. And though you might not be able to make this out, to the right here was a mesa about 400 feet tall, and it had big, big boulders all around. And I said, what am I supposed to do? Now, God, you know, if you gave me a sign, why didn't you give me a direct sign? And why didn't you take and give me markers which way to go or something like that? And I didn't know what to do because surely I wasn't supposed to go up that mesa. And so I fell on my knees again, and I said, God, you've taken me this far, or if this is a sign that you've given me so far, and if you truly are here to show me where my brother is, then you need to give me another sign because I don't know what to do. Did you want me to get on this pipeline cut, or did you want me to stay on that heading? And if you look at that, this line right here, that is the 240-degree heading from where I was. And so I prayed. And when I got up from the prayer, I turned, and it looked like another airplane came right out of the top of that mesa. And you can just barely see it right here. Oh, wrong thing. Right there. This airplane just seemed to come right out of the mesa. And so I got my camera out, and I took a picture of it, and I took another picture at a little bit different location so that I could find this place again. I marked these trees here so I can find the place again, because if this is indeed a sign, I wanted to be start from here when I started looking. And so after I took the picture and I was thinking, Eric said, bad cell phone reception. Look at my cell phone, bad cell phone reception. Big boulders, stay off. There's nothing but big boulders in front of me. And so I went ahead and headed up into the boulders. And I climbed up to these boulders. I was climbing along these boulders, and I was looking under rocks, and I was just looking everywhere. I mean, my eyes and head were going just like this all the time. And so I went a little ways, and I climbed up on this rock, and right on the other side of that rock was an antelope. And it looked at me, and I looked at it, and I said, at least you're not a lion. And I decided to get back to the truck. So I called off the search. I abandoned the search, and I headed home. This is a little close-up view of the area. You see those trees right there? And there's that's the contrail. As the plane got up, the wind was blowing the contrail off just a little bit, and it was sort of making it weak. But nevertheless, that's the same one. So I returned home and got home just before Sabbath that Friday, and the next week I made a number of phone calls trying to find someone to help me up there. Because by this time, my sister and my brother had decided they weren't going to help search for my little brother Keith, and I needed to find someone to help me. So I called Eric Berg, the sheriff's department guy, and I said, Eric, you know, I got some good idea where my brother is. I said, I think I saw some signs there, Eric. I said, I think I might know where he's at. And I said, Eric, but I got to get some help. I need someone to help me go out there. And I said, I would be willing to pay any of your sheriff's deputies to go out there with me for 3 days while I search for Keith out there. And Eric said, well, just so happens we're having a search and rescue meeting this evening. And I'll just ask someone there, ask the guys there if they'd like to come help you. And lo and behold, the next morning, I got a call from Chris White. Well, Chris White was, again, the first guy I talked to other than the dispatcher at the San Miguel County Sheriff's Department. And Chris said, I would love to come up there and help you, but he said, I can't. My wife doesn't want me to be gone for that long. But he said, I've got a younger brother. And my younger brother, I talked to him, and he said he'd love to help you. And I said, well, that's great. What's your brother's name? And he says, Joshua. So I tried to call Joshua, and I couldn't get hold of Joshua. So what I did is I sent Chris an email, because he had given me his email address. And this is the email I sent Chris. And you can't read the whole thing, but what I did is I didn't want Joshua and Chris to think I was a kook and that I was just chasing after false dreams or anything like that. Plus, I didn't want them to think that I was trying to get some police officers out in the middle of the woods and shoot them, because Eric did tell me I could take a gun back up there. In fact, he encouraged me to take a gun with me. But I told Eric, I said, in early January, I came to the conclusion that my brother actually did kill himself, and though he had indicated that my oldest brother... that he didn't want to be found, I found it curious that he left his truck in an open area, and I went on and I told him another thing. So I documented the whole thing to Chris, that, and I had hoped that he was going to give that to Joshua, which he did. And I spelled out everything that I'd done. In fact, I even sent him a picture. I even sent him this picture right here, and I said, this is where I think he is. And I said, and I gave him the coordinates, the coordinates of where we found, where I took that picture from. And I said, Chris, tell Josh this is where I think he is, and I think that I can find him up there, but I'm going to need some help. And my biggest reason for wanting help is because I didn't want to get killed by a bear. And also they had told me that this is a really high area for drug runners and stuff, and he said that they found people dead up there who had been involved in drug business and stuff like that. And I didn't want that to happen to me while I was searching for a dead person. So I took and sent this email off, and I didn't hear from Joshua. And so Sunday came along, and I was ready to leave, and up to this point, I still hadn't had any help. Still didn't have any help. So I loaded up my rifle and my handgun in the back of my truck, and we headed to Colorado. Angie and I headed up to Colorado. This time we drove, and we got going up there. And I didn't tell Angie what my intent was. Because we had no help, my intent was for her to stay down below, sitting up on top of Boulder with a gun in her hand, while I went and searched for my brother. I mean, that's all I had left, okay? But we raced up there, and Angie says we really did race, because normally when we travel, I stop about every 100 miles and get a Coke and a bag of potato chips or something like that. And we didn't stop at all on the way up there. We just drove and drove and drove. And we got near to the place where we were going to spend the night, and I looked at my phone, and I had an email, and I looked at it, and it was from Chris White. Actually, it was from Josh. And Josh wrote, he says, "Hi, Tim, this is Josh White. I'm Chris White's brother. I've been having problems with my cell phone reception and understand that you've been trying to call. I'm with Chris now, and if you call his number, I know he will get reception. I will give you a call later if I don't hear from you. Do you have a local number?" And so on and so on and so on. And so when we got to our room, which is only about 15 minutes away, I called Josh, and Josh says, "I don't know what's been wrong, but I have not been able to get on my cell phone. I can always get out in Norwood," but he says, "for the last 3 days, I've not been able to get out at all." So anyway, after talking to Chris, or to Josh, my heartbeat slowed down, and the weight on my shoulders just vanished, seemed like, because it seemed like Josh was the guy who was going to be able to help me in this endeavor. He knew the area, he was an avid hunter, and he wasn't afraid of lions and bears. That was the big thing. So I made arrangements with Josh that we would meet the next morning at 9 o'clock at a little town called Basin, and we'd meet in the Basin store. This Basin store was right at the corner of this 17-mile dirt road and the county road. And so we decided we would meet there. And so Angie and I got up early in the morning. We had an hour and a half drive to get up there. And we met him there at 9 o'clock at the Basin store. Angie went in to go to the restroom and found out that there was a charge for using the restroom there. They wanted you to at least buy something there. So she went to the restroom and came out, and she picked up this, what was it, honey? A bag of pretzels. And she took it up to the counter, and the lady at the counter says, "Oh, sweetheart, you don't have to pay for that." And Angie says, "Well, I used a restroom." And she says, "Well, we know what you're here for. Josh has been telling everybody, and we've all been praying for you." So we felt encouraged. Josh was a really young-looking guy, though he was 35 years old. And he got in the truck with some strangers who had guns and took off on the 17-mile dirt road, which, by the way, was being smoothed out that morning with a maintainer. So the 45-minute drive in was only about a 15-minute drive because the road was as smooth as silk by then. And we got to the place where my brother's truck was found. And we got out and we got our arsenal together. And we were getting ready to head up to where I thought that I could find my brother. And Josh says, "Well, where are you going to look first?" And I took out my cell phone, which has that picture on it that I showed you earlier of the contrail of the airplane. And I said, "Josh, we're going to look right there, because you see that white line? That's the finger of God. And he's pointing where my brother is." So we walked down to a certain spot, and this is another Google Earth illustration. Right here, right over here, is, oh man, you can't see that very well at all. Whoa. This is the pipeline cut. This is where I took the picture from, And I said, Josh, that's the contrail right there. Of course, this I just put that white line in there. That's the contrail up there. And I said, so we've got to go from here to there because I think that's where my brother was. That's where the airplane came out of the mesa. So we need to go there. And so he said, well, let's go. And so we took off over those very large boulders. Thankfully, we had contacted the sheriff's department that morning and told them that we were going to be out there looking. But we took off, and we started climbing. And you can tell here, this is sort of a diagonal climb. And this elevation right here is about 7,200 feet. And this here is about 7,500 feet, 7,600 feet. So we had about 400 feet to climb. And we were climbing up there, and we're climbing over boulders and all of this. And for those of you who've been seeing me ride bicycles this week, you can see how in shape I was. I mean, I can't even go up this little hill here without getting winded. And so we were climbing on these things. Plus, we were at 7,500 feet elevation where the oxygen is not nearly as good. You can ask Mike. He knows about that. And so we were climbing along, and we get to this point roughly right here. This is about, about two-fifths of a mile. And Josh says, I think I need to go up on top of that ridge. He says, I think one of us ought to go up on top of that ridge and sort of look down. Then we can get two perspectives. And I said, that sounds fine. So Josh said, well, I'm going to take my backpack off and leave it right here. And I'm going to take my rifle and leave it right here. And I said, all right, well, I'm going to leave my rifle here too. By then, I guess we'd realized that, or maybe we just weren't scared anymore. And we left our guns behind pretty much. And so he headed off up on top of the ridge, and Angie and I continued heading that way. And as we climbed higher to the ridge, we started seeing these outcroppings. And I started looking in them, and there's outcroppings where you had to grab hold of rocks and go like this and hold on the limbs and stuff like that in order to get around to them. But I wanted to search everything. And the closer I got to the top up there, you know, I wanted to be detailed. And so Angie was saying, as we were climbing on some of these rocks, do you think Keith really climbed up here after drinking a six-pack of beer? I mean, we're having a hard time of it ourselves, but up with a six-pack of beer, I mean, he's probably down there. He probably fell off one of these rocks and crushed his head, you know. But nevertheless, we kept climbing. And after about 30 minutes, I started to worry about Josh because I hadn't heard anything from him, and I was concerned that maybe he had fallen and hurt himself. And so I said to Angie, I said, we need to get up on top, and we need to start looking for Josh. And so I started looking up, trying to find a way to get up to the ridge because that's where Josh was supposed to be. And I was looking up there, and I found this place. And I said, I think we can get up to the ridge right there. And just then Angie says, well, there's a water bottle. And she says, and there's a backpack. Josh went back and got his backpack. He's ahead of us. And that's what I was thinking. And so I took and looked to the right. And I said, Angie, it's Keith. Don't look. We had found him. We took a direct path, almost a completely direct path from this pot to right to there. And we walked right to him. And I was shaken to death. I wanted to call the sheriff and tell him that we'd found him. And I was just shaking, something terrible. And about that time, I'd been hollering at Josh, and I said, Josh, we found him, we found him. And Josh made his way back, and he grabbed my cell phone, and he made the call to his brother Chris and told Chris that we had found him. We had walked almost directly to him in less than an hour and a half. And they told us we'd never find him. Because of the remoteness of the area, they had to call the sheriff's department had to call a helicopter to come in and airlift my brother's body out. And that is another miracle. And I don't have time to tell you that right now. But he called this helicopter to come out, and they lifted my brother off of the mesa. Now, I mentioned to you that I had spent 4 months praying for three specific things. One was that God would help me to find my brother's body, which he did, and that I would get him buried, and eventually I did. And here's his grave the day that we buried him. But God has not answered my final petition yet, because it's going to take a little bit longer. Because that third petition, those three things I prayed to God, was that I find my brother, I bury my brother, and that I'm there when my brother comes out of that grave. Because I want to be the one to help my brother out of this mess, out of this mess of depression, get him back on the walk that he was raised in, the walk that will lead him to be able to overcome any depression if he were to have it, but lead him to happiness. I believe that God will answer that petition. I know that if God takes no pleasure in the death of the wicked, he certainly doesn't take pleasure in the eternal death of my brother. My brother made some bad choices along the way, but I believe God is more merciful than we are, and even though we try to put him in a box on our view of the resurrections, God lives beyond our little box. I'm reminded of this passage, and it comes to mind quite often when I can't get things figured out. And it says, "Behold, the Lord's hand is not shortened, that it cannot save, or his ear dull, that it cannot hear." God can do things the way he wants to do them. He's not confined by our view of the resurrection. And so I would hope that we may broaden our view of that a little bit for the sake of ourselves, because we're the ones that are doing the worrying. It's not the dead. They're not worrying about anything. Tomorrow is Hoshana Rabbah, the great salvation. The way I understand it, Hoshana Rabbah, or the last great day, pictures the outpouring of God's Holy Spirit during the millennium. It may take place at one time, or it may take place all along the way. I hope it takes place all along the way, because I hope that there's times when God says, "Okay, Tim, it's time for your brother. You need to go out there to Olathe, Colorado, and I want you to be there when your brother comes up." I believe Keith will be raised from the dead on Hoshana, or sometime during the festival season. I believe that God will scold him a little bit, and then he'll let those of us who have been trained to deal with these types of things take him and lead him along the cycles of righteousness and salvation that are portrayed by these festivals that we're in right now. Right now, I'm wanting to conduct my life in such a way that I can be the one who takes my brother by the hand and gently leads him to a better way. And I know that all of you want to do the same thing. Thank you.